I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Across centuries and continents, people in extreme isolation like explorers, climbers, disaster survivors, and astronauts have reported the same eerie experience when they were alone and felt all was lost, the sudden sense that someone else had appeared beside them. Some believe it is a guardian angel, others a deeper part of our own minds, and still others believe it's God. This week's episode is The Third Man Factor.
In the night, your heart fills with dread. Probably a murderer who wants you dead. It could be a ghost, a demon, or worse. Perhaps you're the victim of a witch's curse. It's hopeless, you're doomed. You'd call a priest if you could. You'd rather just listen to who? Sinister Who?
While I was trudging through the frozen tundra of Dallas, listening to the story of Ernest Shackleton in Antarctica, and I was like, I wouldn't make it. I wouldn't have made it out of there. I can barely make it back to my door.
No, man, like so many. We got a whole ice situation over here. This is sadly the ice that I would much prefer. But yeah, and when everyone's like, but it's snow, and we're like, it isn't, though. It's literally like hard ice that has formed a mountain in my backyard that if you walk on it, you don't sink into it. It's just like you slide down it.
That's what I was like walking yesterday, and there were some like sleet patches or whatever where it was still snow-ish. Like some kids were trying to throw it at each other.
Just
and it was like
hitting people in the face with bricks, rocks.
That was... Well, the dust was on top, so if I stepped on the dust, I said it's kind of like walking on the beach, but then underneath it is like a hardwood floor. So it's as if you put sand on a hardwood floor, and you're like,
which no one so, has fun with, but everyone is coming up with very innovative ways to sled around here. I will say that.
Oh, good.
I've seen mattresses, tables, shower curtains.
You gotta get the laundry basket with a rope tied to it and running
Ella
with the laundry,
did the laundry basket. Our street is pretty flat, so it, you know.
Yeah.
And to walk anywhere is a whole thing.
Treacherous.
It's getting the kids in and out of all the shit they got to wear. And for those of you that live in places where it's cold and icy a lot, I'm sure that you have it down to a science and you're very efficient and good at it. But we don't have that here. So it's just like, what are we supposed to wear outside? I couldn't find any of the stuff I bought last year when this happened.
Oh, man.
So I'm like, here's some socks. Put them on your hands.
Well, I'll say one of the, it was a business owners in Dallas said, it's our single ice storm that we have. It's always like 3 days to a week long. Hopefully everybody makes it out on the other side of it. But shout out to everybody who's, luckily everybody's got power mostly, but
around
anybody
here,
who's struggling and doesn't have all that. Hopefully everybody stays plugged in.
Kids have been out of school for a long time.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
I got that text today and I just went, Serenity now! I've closed it again! Oh, and Ella was sick all last week, which was on the tail end of an already long weekend. So she really hasn't been to school in like 2 weeks. And,
man, oh man. All we're doing is sitting at home, doom scrolling.
Yeah. Our problems are minimal compared to people in Minnesota and elsewhere.
Yeah, send in love to everybody out there. Anybody who knew or was in the community with Alex Preddy, we're so sorry to hear about his extrajudicial execution in the streets. If you have any questions about what's going on, we are thinking about doing a what the fuck is going on kind of an episode where we discuss the crimes that are happening before our very eyes on social media, where we can't really look away, literally. And because if we do, the government will tell us like, an elephant came out of nowhere with a tutu on. And you're like, I don't know. I watched the video and it didn't seem, I didn't see that. So if you have any questions, legal questions, I'll try. Are there laws? Don't send that in because I don't have the answer to it. But especially if you are in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area and you have resources you want us to share, while little bitty Greg Bovino got sent back to his Polly Pocket House
and is Gregory. No longer...
Little Greg is sent away, but they are sending Tom Homan in. They're not leaving. So there are still people being terrorized as we speak. So if you are in that area and you know of a business that needs support, someone that's helping other people, ways to get connected that you feel comfortable, we can keep you anonymous, but that you feel comfortable with us sharing on the air, we would love to share that as well as answer any questions you have.
Yeah, I think we all feel a sense of hopelessness, isolation, fear. Depression, sadness. I know I felt all of these just today that's pretty much every day. And whatever we can do to help ease that some, or like you said, answer questions. I mean, I know so many people are like, but how could this happen? And even with a law degree, I don't know that. Because answer is all the things put in place to protect us, they've just said, fuck it, which nobody really does, which we didn't anticipate, you know?
No, certainly. And I will say, too, we can bring forward news stories that hopefully will make you feel less hopeless. Like, for instance, there's a show cause hearing out to hold a DHS official in contempt of court for all of the many violations of court orders that ICE has been having. So the results of these interventions, lawsuits that have been filed, there's positive movement forward. I don't want anyone to think that it's like we have no laws anymore. That's not true. We have a court system. We have Congress. There is a funding deadline for DHS this week on the 30th. So you should call your senators, representatives. I called both of our senators and I was real country. And I was like, you're going to let that Swiss cheese man in the White House take my guns away? I don't think so. I need you to vote to take away funding from ICE. I mean, say whatever you need to say that would hopefully get them to stop the madness. But I don't want anyone to feel desolate, desperate, like there's nothing to go on. I think sometimes the antidote to that is action. So being frozen inside, we're like, we can research. So send your questions in to go to sinisterhood.com/contact and just put it under the main feed episode. Just act like you're submitting a topic for the main feed and I'll pull them all out of there just so they're all in one place. So sinisterhood.com/contact for questions, resources, whatever, just so we all feel like we're not taking crazy pills.
Yeah. I said yesterday, I was like, and this episode was pretty much finished. So we're doing this episode this week, but I was like, it feels strange to just continue talking about things without addressing what's going on. And I've seen a lot of like creators, celebrities, whoever saying that, like, because there's been like a lot of award shows lately and everything, and everyone's like, sure, we're all here accepting best actor, but like, we gotta bring a reality to this situation right now because it's insane what's happening. And I think it's only going to get worse before it gets better, but something's gonna change. Something's going to change.
Certainly. You know what? As we'll hear today in this episode,
the sirens in the background, which are probably weather related over here.
Probably. But as we go through this episode and talk about dire circumstances, you know, a third man doesn't always appear and help people. Sometimes people just die of old age or whatnot. But also, may we all have our own third man as we walk through this horrific situation we're all in. And it's a shitty time. Things are bad. We all need something to look forward to. So we've got something to look forward to, something we can all do together that'll be a good time. We're going to talk about it on Friday. So make sure you tune in to Freaky Friday. Be sure you're following us on socials. And we've got a fun little announcement that will give us Well, hold on for one more day. Like Wilson Phillips said.
Oh, yes. I had a breakdown doing my Lego Botanicals to Pink's Pretty Pretty Please last night. Oh, shit.
We're all. You know what? Sometimes the music hits.
Oh, dude. I don't know. My Spotify was on fire the other night. And I
was it doing good?
Have always liked Pink. But I, like, when I, several of her songs came on, I was like, all of these are evergreen. They're still so relatable right now. And they're like so like empowering. And it was great. And I also have to say a lot of Hillary Duff's new songs came up.
Oh, I didn't know that. Incredible.
Oh, my gosh.
Check her out.
Mature is a banger.
Oh, I've not listened. No, I've been a Pink fan since like I was a teenager, since Get This Party Started. And her concert was one of the most inspirational. It was women of all ages. I did not feel that inspired until I later went to the Eras Tour. That's how it was very, fuck it, you got this, like, power within. So I would like to go ahead and conjure, if I'm ever in a disaster scenario, I hope I get the visage of Pink being like...
You'd get out of there.
Get this you'd party get
out,
started.
You'd get out of there with Pink. You'd climb a mountain with Pink. 100%. Or 100%. Miley.
I'd die.
A lot of Miley came on,
Miley's
too.
There.
It was like all the girlies, and they all were killing it vocally. So, yeah.
Hell yeah.
Well, I'm Christy.
I'm Heather.
And let's get into it. The experience has been called many things. In popular accounts, it's usually referred to as third man syndrome or the third man factor. It's the sensation that an unseen companion has appeared beside a person at the moment when they are most alone. Researchers tend to avoid the poetic label. In academic literature, the phenomenon is more often described as
felt presence, sensed presence, or a presence hallucination.
People who encounter the phenomenon often speak of it as a companion, someone who seems to occupy space. Third man walks along them, offers guidance, or makes survival possible. What makes the third man factor accounts unique is the conditions that usually precede its appearance. Time and again, the third man emerges during moments of extreme strain, like physical exhaustion, hunger, injury, isolation, fear, and proximity to death. Long before the phenomenon acquired its modern name, human beings recognized this pattern. In Christian scripture, the Gospel of Luke recounts how two followers of Jesus walked along a road after the crucifixion. A stranger joined them, spoke with them, and walked for miles at their side. Only later did they come to believe that the stranger had been Christ himself. The narrative is often read theologically, but its structure is recognizable. Two men in a crisis of despair and isolation on a long journey, and the sudden appearance of a benevolent and comforting companion.
When I was a little girl, my mamaw had one of those posters. It was like a wooden poster, and it was like that poem where it was like, and there was one set of footprints, and it was when you carried me, and I thought of her whenever I was reading this stuff.
My grandparents had the same one. I know exactly what you're talking about.
But yeah, in scripture, there it's multiple cases, and it's across religions too. But there's a part of Daniel, I think chapter 3, they say the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. So there's mentions anytime I think you're going to be walking through a desert for a long time, somebody's going to show up. And I think whatever wig you put on him is your own belief system mentally.
Maybe it looks like Christ. Maybe it looks like a body of water with a little palm tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, horsemen. In cartoons, I always thought that if you walked in the desert long enough, you would see an oasis.
I was like, that's a thing, right? No, it's yes, it's a mirage.
I don't know if it is or
well,
not.
Well, mirages are a thing. Yeah, I was as a kid, I was like, is that real? And it's like, well, yeah, but it's not like in the cartoons. It's like an island with a palm tree on it. My parents were like, don't look for the palm tree because it's
and
not going to be there.
And they run up and start drinking water only to come up with a mouthful of sand.
Every time.
Sand was a big fear mongerer as a kid.
Kids? Oh, I mean, I told you
like
I was...
sand?
Yeah, traumatized.
Mirages in sand, sand dunes.
I was always like, am I going to get trapped in the desert one day and be walking around? And I never... You know, as a kid, you're just like, that could happen. And you don't think... But, like, it probably won't. Like, you... There's a lot of steps between me and trekking across the desert landscape that I could
even
stop.
Even getting to
I
a
could
desert.
Stop it. Exactly. Yeah. I could stop myself. We're on the flight. We're going to be at the Sahara soon. And I'm just like, I'm going to stay on. Y'all take me back. We're going back. We're going back.
It would... be a minute before from our where we live, we got to a desert. So we'd have a lot of time to think when we were driving, like, is this really something I want to involve myself in?
I'm like, there's not a lot of grass or trees around here. I need to go back.
I don't like sand and dirt in my shoes either.
Also that was, I love Marfa, Texas. I love West Texas. I love Big Bend. And every time we come back, I'm like, take my shoe and just dump it out. Like, it looks like a sand ceremony at a wedding because there's just sand.
Other religious traditions contain similar motifs. Jewish mystical literature describes a divine presence that accompanies those who suffer. In Islam, stories of angelic intervention in moments of danger appear in both scripture and tradition. Indigenous cultures across North America, Australia, and Siberia describe vision quests in which individuals, alone and exposed to the elements, encounter guiding spirits who provide instruction or protection. In many cultures, the dead are believed to accompany the living through periods of grief or peril.
I love whenever we do something like this and we see how alike we all are in so many ways, in that our cultural traditions, it makes me think of on TikTok, if you've ever been on TikTok, where it's like, for me, it would be like, Southern grandmas always be like, and then it's these things. Well, then people in the comments would be like, oh my gosh, I'm from Mexico and my grandma said the same thing, or I'm from upstate New York and my grandma said the same thing. And it's, I think oftentimes we think, oh, well, only, you know, Southern grandmas be like, there was one set of footprints and that's when Jesus carried me. And it's like, there, when there's similarities, I think, in cultures that TikTok and other social media lets us, when it's not trying to divide us and make us insane, lets us realize how much normal, like how much more similar we are than different.
Mm-hmm. You'll see a lot in those types of TikToks in the comments, like, are we just all living the same life? Did we all have the same childhood?
Yeah.
And it, in a lot of ways, yes, especially depending on, like, you all grew up in the 90s, like, there's, you know, a lot of stereotypes of kids that grew up in the 90s that are true as a kid that grew up in the 90s. And when you see those, like, Gen X, name a movie that makes you feel like you're super old. And in the comments, I'm just like, man, I remember seeing that in the theaters. I remember that. And it is this sense of community and camaraderie, even with strangers. But it allows you to see, like, we're not as different as everyone wants to make it seem, especially now. Like, we are more alike than we are different, despite what the administration and others want you to believe.
I think we're 8 billion little Venn diagrams and we all somehow, like, overlap in certain ways. And we may not all overlap each other, but, like, ring-wise, we all... It's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
We're all 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon from each other.
Man. I got to look up later, like, how that started. I wonder. That might be a mini-sode.
No,
like,
yeah.
How did it get... How did it become Kevin Bacon is my question. I love Kevin Bacon. I want to know if it was just because he was in a ton of movies at the time and everyone was like, well, he's the it guy right now. So we can all, like, they're somehow. Like,
this guy, he's everywhere.
He's also everywhere.
Kevin Bacon sounds like John Pork's cousin.
John Pork.
If you don't know John Pork, you will.
Go search John Pork on TikTok and just have some laughs.
Enjoy. John Pork can unite us.
If anybody can unite us, it's going to be John Pork. These narratives differ in theology, symbolism, and interpretation. What they share is the recognition that under certain conditions, human beings may experience the presence of another when no physical companion is present. For much of history, these experiences were described and recounted as part of the spiritual realm. But by the late 1800s to early 1900s, these types of accounts were included in more secular autobiographical records. In 1895, Joshua Slocum set sail from Boston on the Spray, beginning what would become the first solo circumnavigation of the globe. He completed the journey in 1898 and published his account, Sailing Alone Around the World, 2 years later. The book is practical, discussing navigation, repairs, weather, and self-reliance. And yet at one point in the narrative, Slocum describes an odd episode. Slocum was exhausted and ill as he struggled to remain awake at the helm one night. At the moment of complete exhaustion, he became aware of a presence aboard the boat. He later wrote that he perceived the figure as the ghost of an old sailor, who he identified as
the pilot of the Pinta.
The sailor had come to guide him. Slocum believed the figure stood watch over the helm while he rested. For later readers, the episode seemed like an early secular account of what would eventually be called the Third Man.
Yeah, when he got back, before his book came out, Slocum told the Boston Globe writers about it, and they published an article called Spook on Spray, because the boat was called Spray, and this was like a ghost. But yeah, also Spray, if I ever got a boat, I'm calling it Spray, first of all. Hilarious.
Oh, but Spook on Spray sounds
it's
like
crazy. It's
a pornographic Dr. Seuss.
Sounds crazy. And I don't want to know the rhymes, but the quote that he said that the phantom said to him was, "Lie quiet and I will guide your ship tonight." And he described him as a phantom sailor, a friend, and a seaman of vast experience. But yeah, he said he was grateful. He's like, if it weren't for him, I would have died. I slept while he steered the boat. And I'm like, who was sleeping and who was steering? That's what I'm trying to know.
All I know is there was semen being sprayed,
you know,
all over the spray.
Full of semen.
A spray full of semen. But, you know, whatever helped him get through that, whether it was a past semen or just his own brain being like, you got to get some fucking sleep because you're going to drown and crash this boat if you don't. And your subconscious takes over. I don't know. The most frequently cited accounts belong to Sir Ernest Shackleton. In 1914, Shackleton led the Imperial Trans-Antarctic Expedition, intending to make the first land crossing of Antarctica. Their ship, Endurance, became trapped in ice and was eventually crushed. The loss of their ship kicked off a prolonged struggle for survival. The men spent months adrift on ice floes and were forced into a desperate boat journey across the Southern Ocean. Finally, they completed a hazardous crossing of South Georgia Island to reach help.
I wish I could meet Ernest Shackleton because I need to know somebody, like, how charismatic do you have to be to convince 30 people to come to Antarctica with you when you just decided to be an explorer? He was like a merchant mariner, certainly, but he said, I just want to walk across Antarctica. Let's go. Some dudes were like, let's fucking go, man.
Let's fucking
Meanwhile,
do it.
Meanwhile, cut to, you crash your boat. You're stuck in ice for 15 months, the seas are coming everywhere. It's constantly raining. There's snow squalls everywhere. That he tells the guys, we got to drag like some small boats with us. We'll drag them over. They go get to some water, had to sail through the water, get to this place called Elephant Island, drop people off there. Had to walk to get somewhere to drop off. Then left the majority of the crew there, took a couple guys with them. Then they had to sail 680 miles through the Drake Passage, which if you've ever seen on TikTok, people on cruise ships, it's terrifying to go through the Drake Passage.
Yeah, in a cruise ship, it's terrifying. It's terrifying.
This was like a smaller mini boat. So they had 17 days on their boat to do that. Frostbite everywhere. Like they were sleeping three to a cubby inside the ship, which they said was like a coffin. And then you would just like still get bonked around. But it was like the only way to stay warm and reasonably tied down, essentially. One guy woke up in a panic because he was like, I thought I was in a coffin. But then they get to South Georgia during a hurricane. They just start drinking whatever water they could find. Yeah, of course it's a fucking hurricane. And then he's like, well, we know there's a whaling station that could save us. And basically Shackleton's like, I drug all these dudes out here. If I don't get somewhere, like, we're not going to make it. So by then it was down to three. And him and the two other dudes were like, we have to walk 24 miles through ice fields, glaciers with mountains. They had no climbing tools. They had 15 feet of line, but 22 people would die if they didn't keep going. And he was just like, we got to keep going, like walked in silence. And it literally was like that last stretch that it was like, I can't do this, man. Yeah. I can't. I'm going to die. There's 20 people waiting for me and I'm going to die. And he's like, we have no food. I'm like, you can't climb. I couldn't climb a mountain with all the equipment.
No.
It was crazy.
The temperatures alone, I would have been done before I started.
Dunzo.
It's a lot of pressure when you've kind of put this whole thing together and then you're like, well, that didn't go well.
It's like when you plan the girls trip and then like the reservations get canceled or the restaurant's not very good. And it's like, you didn't read the reviews before you got a reservation. That's fine.
How many times on that walk though, was one of those men like, I'm just saying, if we had done a little bit of planning, I'm just saying, Shackleton.
That's like the worst part too, is when they got to South Georgia Island, the whaling station was on the other side of the island. And you know, you're like, God damn it. Did we just fucking land? And they're like, it's fine. It's fine. We can walk. It's fine. We'll just walk. That's Heather. We'll just walk. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you have no other choice. It's like walk or die.
Seriously. And if and not just you die, the guys would die and nobody knew that they had crashed. So no one knew they were anywhere. So they all the three of them would have died. The people they left on Elephant Island would have died. I mean, they're all done.
Seems like if you're going to embark upon such an endeavor, you got to have some experience. Somebody involved that knows some shit.
We're going to need a bigger boat.
Much bigger.
Much bigger. Sinister Hood will be right back. Well, you all know I've had two dogs, and what better time to announce I've gotten a third than a commercial? We're here to talk about my new dog named Philly, and she's awesome. And she, the problem is, we don't know where she came from. We adopted her from Dallas Animal Services, so we've got to take care of every aspect from head to toe because we love her, and she's a sweet little addition to the family. And the Goose and Buff are getting older, so there's a lot of stuff. I've always got to keep my eyes on them and make sure they're taken care of.
Our pets are so important. We cover everything else in our lives, our cars, our phones, even our trips. But our pets, they deserve that same protection. ASPCA Pet Health Insurance helps you be ready for whatever life throws at your pet, whether it's a chewed up sock or an unexpected vet bill.
And when you enroll in an ASPCA Pet Health Insurance plan, you could get a $25 Amazon gift card. It's a little treat for you while you're doing something great for your pet. The plans are customizable to fit your budget and your pet's quirks. And it's been around nearly 20 years, helping almost a million pets.
To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/creepy. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/creepy.
Eligibility restrictions apply. Visit aspcapetinsurance.com/creepy for more info. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
It was during this last ordeal in May 1916 that Shackleton reported a strange sensation. He and the two other men, Frank Worsley and Tom Crean, were crossing the island's mountainous interior with minimal equipment, no map, and almost no food. They were exhausted and near collapse. In his account, titled South, published in 1919, Shackleton wrote that throughout the journey, he had the persistent impression that someone else was with them, writing,
"It seemed to me often that we were four, not three."
The line was sparse, and Shackleton did not elaborate or dramatize the experience. He simply recorded it as a matter of perception. What gives the account additional weight is that later, when the three men discussed the journey, each independently acknowledged a similar feeling. The men could not explain it and did not try to. His companion, Frank Worsley, independently reported the same sensation.
"There was indeed one thing about our crossing of South Georgia, a thing which I have never been able to explain. I had the subconscious feeling that there were four of us instead of three."
And Shackleton didn't talk about it until a couple months afterwards. He was in Australia with a secretary, like a guy that was taking notes while Shackleton was just orating. He was just saying what happened out loud and somebody taking notes. And that when he got to this point, that Shackleton was like, "There is much that cannot be told." And then he was like, "I'm going through it all. I can't. And like freaked out and panicked, which sounds in retrospect, you know, 110 years later, like probably some PTSD he had going on. But that when the scribe was like, "What are you talking about?" He explained this. And then the scribe later on was like, "Was there anything weird about South Georgia?" And separately, the other guys were like, "You mean the extra party member that we had?"
Yeah. And none of them had discussed it amongst each other.
No, because they were embarrassed about it. And Shackleton was kind of embarrassed about it, too. And like, would talk about it later, kind of jokingly, like, "Oh, yes, the Phantom." And they would say, "What do you think it was?" And he would always say, "Providence. Providence." Like, he just used that word, providence, and would like kind of joke, but when he told the story, people would just, you could hear a pin drop. They said like they were addicted, I think, to hearing a science, rational, you know, normally like all of his books are pretty, you know, this is where we went and what we did, to be like, "And then a ghost appeared." They're like, the fuck?
But also to be on that journey as one of those three men and all independently feel this is going on, yet no one's communicating this to the other one. So everyone's kind of experiencing their own peril and their own third man that's guiding. Like, You know what I mean? Was it one for all three, or did each three have one?
That's a good question, because I wondered if one of them were to say, like, I don't want to sound crazy, but do you think there's like somebody else with us? Because they said just a couple years before that, at the end of World War One, there was a widely reported newspaper, you know, widely reported in newspapers, an incident of British soldiers who were at this particularly treacherous battle, and that one guy was like, oh my God, that's an angelic horseman. But he didn't say that at first. He was like, oh my gosh, look, the French cavalry's coming. And like, can't you see that guy on horseback? And then that other guy and that other guy and the people around him. Is it a shared psychosis? I don't know. But other soldiers started going, oh yeah, that, oh my gosh, thank God the French cavalry's coming. And then as they got closer, they all sort of vanished into this white mist. And everyone's like, are we tired? Are we hungry? Did we just see ghost horsemen?
Was it a mirage? Yeah. Are we in the desert?
They were like, I got a mouthful of sand now.
Yeah, it's wild though. I mean, and we'll get into what might cause those things to happen. The episode has become a key event in later discussions of the phenomenon. Part of its power lies in its understatement. Shackleton was not a man known for flights or fancy. His writing elsewhere is controlled, pragmatic, even austere. The sentence appears without emphasis, but he nevertheless included it to complete the picture of his journey. 3 years after Shackleton's book appeared, T.S. Eliot published the poem The Wasteland. In one of its most quoted passages, he describes a journey through a barren landscape.
Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look ahead up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you.
Beautiful. And would imply he can see the other person's third man.
It sounds like it, yeah, that it would be a collective experience. Yeah, this was the most famous English language poem of the 20th century. And there was like a Notes to the Wasteland that he published afterwards that kind of gave insight onto his, I guess, his inspiration. And he said this part was inspired by an Antarctic expedition. I forget which, but I think it was one of Shackleton's. And I'm like, you got to remember that man almost died.
First of all, how many have there been? I forget which one.
People, man, I think that was the early 1900s thing. It's like people trying to go to Mars now. It was like, I'm going to go to Antarctica. People like, okay.
Or Everest or, yeah, anything to feel a...
extreme.
Conquering, like you completed a huge quest, and there's something to be said for like walking where no one else has, and you're the first one. A lot of people, that's their whole thing, is they like going places like that.
Gotta be first, baby.
Even though he was not reporting direct facts, Eliot's words resonated strongly with readers familiar with Shackleton's account. Over time, the phrase, the third man, became a kind of shorthand for the experience of an unseen companion appearing in moments of extreme distress.
Shackleton died in 1922, but do you think that he would have been like, actually, it was the fourth man the rest of his life? I know the poem. True. I get it. I hear you. I hear you on the poem, but like, I was kind of the one, and it was actually fourth.
I'm like the OG to experience this, and there were three of us, so it's the fourth man.
It's actually fourth man.
Could make sense, though.
It may be, but if Shackleton went back to Antarctica in 1922 and took eight of the men from the original thing, how good do you have to be that those guys got stuck and they still came back? But he unfortunately died of a heart attack and got buried where he was initially rescued from, down there. But I would have been insufferable about this.
I think, I'm like, you want me to go back? I mean, on one hand, he got you through it. So you're like, well, he's capable. On the other hand, you're like, I'll be goddamn if I'm going through something like that.
Your husband comes in like, hey, babe, I got a new, I'm going to go on a trip. Another one's going to be a couple months. You're not going with Shackleton. I am actually going with him. The guy who got you stuck in the fucking ice floe, the guy who got me rescued from the ice floe. Yeah, I know that, but you wouldn't have been stuck.
Yeah. It's, you're right. He had to have a lot of charm and charisma. Something. Yeah, good or speaker, money. Good motivational speaker or money, true. As the 20th century progressed, accounts of similar experiences surfaced in unexpected places. Although tales of the third man seemed more common among polar expeditions or solo sailors, increasingly experiences emerged from the Himalayas, aircraft cockpits, hospital beds, and disaster zones, all with the same or similar patterns. Mountaineers have long worked at the limits of human endurance. They experience hypoxia, dehydration, sleep deprivation, and isolation in some of the most punishing conditions. Many of the most detailed accounts of felt presence come from high altitudes. In 1933, British climber Frank Smythe was making a solo attempt on Mount Everest. Later, he wrote that he became aware of what felt like another climber accompanying him. The sensation was so vivid that he once found himself dividing food as though preparing to share it. He later recalled,
"All the time I was climbing alone, I had a strong feeling that I was accompanied by a second person."
He was not frightened by the presence. Rather, it alleviated his loneliness.
And he had started with a team, old Smythe, and they got farther. And as they got further, people dropped off of the team. It was only him and one other dude at like 27,000 feet. And the other guy was like, "I can't keep going. I got to stop." And dude, Smythe was like, that's the death zone. And you're also not supposed to camp in the death zone.
Don't get me started on Mount Everest.
Well, this is 1933, too.
No, true. Like back then, the mountain wasn't littered with trash and bodies and everybody's waste just all over the place. However, the conditions were even worse than to climb in because they didn't have Sherpas going ahead of them and laying out all the ropes and everything. So to do this with two people and then down to one, I mean, I believe it's one out of every four climbers, and this is like current statistics, that attempt to climb Mount Everest will die.
Yeah.
You have a one in four chance of dying. Those are odds I'm never going to take, especially because that mountain has been destroyed by humans.
Mm-hmm. That's a sad thing.
Yeah.
But he said that when Smythe was on there, he said the last 1,000 feet of Everest are not for mere flesh and blood because it is so difficult. But he said he felt he was tied to another guy by the rope. He said he felt not at all lonely. He goes, "If I would have fallen, I know that guy would have, I know he would have got me." Nobody's there, by the way. Mm-hmm. And then he stopped to camp for a minute and he had this like single piece of cake and he said he cut it up in two and then was like, wow, why did I do that? He also said he likened it to he was drunk. Like he felt like at some points he felt like he could see himself get up, which like a doppelganger of himself. But other times it was just this sense that it was a companion that was kind of near him. So it's interesting that there's overlap in these experiences if they're not exactly the same.
Yeah, the altitude with that, I think, can be a factor. I mean, if they had oxygen, sometimes people will climb without it, and it's crazy. It's a very, very dangerous thing to do. But to have lack of oxygen, I mean, your brain can't last very long and will start hallucinating. And but if you are feeling so assured that if I fall, this guy's going to catch me, I think that assurance helps you complete your journey. Like, because for me, loneliness and fear would be the reason that I couldn't make it. Like, I'm like, I am all by myself. If something happens, there's no one to help me.
And that the feeling alleviate, that word got used a lot. It alleviated my fear, alleviated my loneliness. And with Shackleton, when he heard the steam whistle of the whaling boats, he said the presence was gone. And with Smythe, he said when he was climbing back down from afar, he saw the camp with his friends. And he said the presence was gone. And he said he felt sad and lonely again. And he's like, where did it go? Like, you were just here. And then it's like, but it's like, kind of, I've done my part. You'll be okay. Keep going. But
I shepherded you to where you needed to be, and now I got to go find someone else that's stuck in the ice and help them.
Sinisterhood, we'll be right back.
Every January, we're always told to reinvent ourselves. But what if you don't want a new you? Nutrafol believes that real hair growth starts from within through consistent care and nourishment, not quick fixes. We love that they focus on lasting change, helping you support your hair and confidence day by day with real results that build over time.
Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand, trusted by over 1.5 million people. You can feel great about what you're putting into your body since Nutrafol hair growth supplements are backed by peer-reviewed studies and NSF content certified, the gold standard in third-party certification for supplements.
See thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding in just 3 to 6 months with Nutrafol. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month's subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code CREEPY.
Find out why Nutrafol is the best-selling hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code CREEPY. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code CREEPY.
Decades later, in 1970, Austrian climber Reinhold Messner reported a similar phenomenon in the Himalayas while descending Nanga Parbat, the ninth highest mountain on Earth. This climb came after the death of his brother. Messner later said that he felt accompanied by a presence that seemed to advise him, telling him where to go and helping him maintain focus.
Yeah, if the presence is going to take a piece of my cake, it better give me some advice.
While in the Himalayas, climber Stephen Venables described the comforting presence of an elderly figure who seemed to guide him towards survival during a desperate night on Kanchenjunga, the third highest mountain in the world. The details of each man's account differ, but the tone remains the same. None of the men claim to have a mystical revelation or religious experience. As serious professionals in a dangerous industry, they speak with the practical vocabulary of people accustomed to evaluating risk and perception. The men do not fear the presence in most cases. It comes as a stabilizing, even helpful entity that accompanies, guides, and keeps the spare at bay.
Yeah, it's interesting that they're all technical people. And so it's like there was a climber with me or a sailor with me.
Yeah, and Reader's like, I thought you were by yourself. He's like, I don't know.
I thought
there was
so
another
too.
Person there. I can't explain so. It, but it happened, and that's all I'm saying about it. And it is something, like you said, when someone that is not their norm, you know, reveals something like that, it almost holds more weight because you're like, this isn't something that you would normally like tiptoe into, more of a spiritual type thing. And you're speaking about it so plainly that it seems like it for you really happened.
Well, and I think you have a lot to lose if you are have to keep your wits about you and have a good head on your shoulders for people to follow you up 27,000 feet or whatever, that you don't want to go around going, I see ghosts all the time. But they felt a lot of these guys, when they came forward with their experience, were like, I couldn't not tell someone about this.
Yeah. It was so
like
overwhelming. Yeah. And life changing.
Well, and, it almost is like kind of, I don't want to say like stolen glory, but it's like, well, I mean, I didn't really do it by myself.
Mm-hmm. Charles Lindbergh's solo flight across the Atlantic in 1927 lasted more than 33 hours. He later wrote about experiencing what he called
phantoms
in the cockpit. These were figures who seemed to appear and speak with him. They were not grotesque or chaotic hallucinations. He described them as calm, conversational, and almost courteous. Lindbergh recalled them as offering reassurance and company at a moment when his ability to remain awake was faltering.
He said he was crossing the bridge, which one sees only in last departing moments. He said he felt like he was like, I mean, if you think about that, this you're flying by yourself and you're the only one in the cockpit. That is the last departing moment.
It is. And I mean, mountain, airplane, both have their pros and cons. A mountain, at least you're on the ground.
Yeah, right. You
but
can't
I mean,
tumble.
You're kind of on the ground. Yeah. You're on the side of a mountain.
Yeah.
A plane, like, you pass out, there's nothing it's going to do but crash.
Yeah, eventually, yeah. Yeah, with no one behind the helm, certainly. So he 33 plus hours, he made it to Paris, and they said there was like 150,000 people waiting for him. And I'm sure he was like, yes, yes, I flew. Anyways, does anyone want to hear about my phantoms? I did not fly alone.
Do.
But he didn't tell anybody about it for, I may be overstating it, but like 10, 20, 30 years. Like, it was like a long time afterwards that he was like, I have to be honest, there were some phantoms.
Mm-hmm. Like the mountaineers, Lindbergh did not connect the experience to a greater spiritual awakening or claim that the phantoms were objectively real. He simply recorded that they appeared. While in his presence, they seemed autonomous, and they helped him endure the ordeal. In 1985, British climber Joe Simpson fell into a crevasse in the Peruvian Andes, shattering his leg. Believing him dead, his climbing partner left to seek help. Simpson found himself alone, injured, and miles from safety. In his memoir, Touching the Void, he described the long crawl back to camp, guided in part by what he experienced as a distinct internal voice. The voice was calm and directive. It told him when to rest and when to move. It did not feel like his ordinary internal monologue. He wrote that the presence felt as though it came from elsewhere.
I mean,
this is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, is it so good?
Incredible. Like, it's firsthand interviews with the climbers reflecting back on what happened in a very well done dramatization reenactment of what they went through happening while they're talking about it. And what this man went through, bonkers. Like, I mean, for anyone to survive that is insane. And he did. And I mean, he talks about in the documentary too, just like hallucinating being completely alone. I mean, in the end, when he kind of passed out, he woke up and was like, what is that smell? So close to camp that he was laying in where everyone went to the bathroom.
No.
So he was laying in people's waste, but he was like, that meant I knew I was close to camp. And he could like see lights down where his fellow climbers had camped. But the voice kind of told him like, rest. And he also had a broken fucking leg. So he would just like hop or scoot on his butt, kind of crawl like across these huge boulders and ice. I'm going to have to rewatch that documentary.
Yeah,
since we're all stuck at home. It's so, so good. I thought we had talked about it. It for a documentary.
Oh, well, we watched Free Solo. So maybe it was like we were talking about, maybe it was one of those. But I was just having read about it. The fact that he broke his ankle and the guy tried to kind of let him down on the rope to like kind of lower him down because it was on their descent. And then to kind of say, hey, I can't hold this rope anymore because I'm going to now be pulled over.
Yeah.
And to let the guy down saying like, sorry, like I'll go get help.
Eye to eye.
Dude, I gotta go, bud. Like, I'm sorry. He said he thought it was snow and he's like, I gotta save my own life. But yeah, having that voice that's just like, it's time to go. It's time, like, rest, move, crawl. Mm-hmm. Like, escaping the crevasse, crawling across a glacier, making it to base camp. And there's like no really minimal water, like pretty much no food. And his foot was all infected because it was broken. Or his leg was all infected because it was broken. Yeah, it was
making
crazy.
It out of that crevasse alone is unbelievable.
Crazy. Yeah.
The one, at least in the documentary, you're just like, if I dropped down into this, I'd be like, well, I might as well get comfortable because this is where I die.
Yeah. Game over. I'm just like,
yeah,
fucking Dracula.
Let me just lay back and deal with it.
Start to
he
try
didn't
to,
know, which is,
no,
you know, I mean, which is a true testament to the desire for survival too when you find yourself in a situation like that.
Truly. But in his writing, he didn't say like, oh, God came and talked to me, or it was Jesus or whatever. He said, it was not me. It was someone else giving me instructions that was separate from me. And it was more rational than how I was feeling.
There's been one time in my life that I can recall feeling this happen.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, I was not climbing the side of a mountain and fell into a crevasse of ice. I was driving in a car and was lost. And if you know me from before we had GPS and stuff, like getting lost was one of my biggest fears. Mm. And being lost in a car and like driving and trying to figure out where you're going before, like we all had MapQuest and GPS and all that stuff.
Turn by turn. Mm-hmm.
Oh, dude, I would be like in a constant panic. It was a real fear I had, like going everywhere because I don't have a good sense of direction. And I was driving on the highway and like I didn't know where I was. And I just remember this calm presence, feeling a calm presence in the car. And it felt like my great grandmother.
Oh, interesting.
Which is interesting because I've never really felt her presence before or after, but it really was this flood of calm that came over me that was like, you've got this. I know what I'm doing. And like, it was like, this is where you're going to exit. And I don't know. I've never been able to explain it.
Damn, granny take the wheel. I love that. Hell yeah.
Mama took the wheel, y'all.
Mama took the wheel, baby. Hell yeah.
Similar accounts have appeared in narratives of disaster survival, Ron DeFrancesco was working on the 84th floor of the South Tower of the World Trade Center on the morning of September 11, 2001, when United Airlines Flight 175 struck the building at 9:03 a.m., smoke and debris quickly spread through the floors above and below. Stairwells were damaged and visibility dropped. DeFrancesco began making his way down the stairs, not expecting to survive. In interviews years later, he described the conditions as disorienting and physically exhausting. During the descent, he reported becoming aware of a presence. He did not hear a voice or see a figure specifically. He felt the steady, calm sensation that someone was accompanying him. He later said it seemed to stabilize him in moments when panic might have taken over. He was among the very few people to escape alive from the impact zone of the South Tower. He exited the building seconds before it collapsed.
Yeah, being above the impact zone, you know, at first he was like, I think I'm going to go down. And his coworkers and people were like, oh, no, like, it's fine. Helicopters are going to come save us. It's like, no big deal. And he and others were trying to help. You know, it's just like all chaos. And he just knew he had to move this direction and go down these stairs. And he said he knew people were following behind him. And sadly, most of the people that decided later to follow him did not make it out. But he made it out as only one of, I mean, a handful of people. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't the only one on 9/11 to have a feeling like this. Will Jimeno, who was a Port Authority police officer, the building was collapsing around him. And he said he believed he saw Jesus walk toward him. And he was trapped under the rubble and debris. And it's not funny, but it's sweet because he was desperate. He was so thirsty. And he said when Jesus got up to him, he went, if I go to heaven, can I get a glass of water?
Oh.
And then he said the presence was like, not verbatim, but was like, nah, man, you're not going to heaven right now. Like, chill. Like, just don't worry about it. You're going to be okay. He said that it passed on the message to him. And the message was like, you'll get water. It will not be in heaven. You will be okay. Mm-hmm. And they said 2,800 human people were buried by the collapse of the World Trade Center. He was one of only 20 people that emerged from what they called the pile. And that he was, the fucking thing collapsed on him. And so for him, he was a religious person. So he believed he saw Jesus. But for others, it's like this presence, Mimoff, whatever, you know. Sinisterhood, we'll be right back.
Well, we're trapped inside, but that's okay because I've got some hero bagels, some hero slice bread. And I'm like, babe, can you make me a scrambled egg and cheese sandwich on one of those everything hero bagels? It is so good.
Not the everything bagel, baby. Ooh, well, with Hero Bread, you can focus on your health goals and still indulge in the soft, fluffy experience you love. Like enjoying a nutritious breakfast wrap, some avocado toast, grilled cheese with a cozy soup, or family burger night. Their products are delicious and flavorful, but have ultra low net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and are high in fiber. Paris loves the sandwich loaf. He's constantly eating sandwiches all the time.
Oh, same.
Yeah.
I love a sandwich. The kids love them. The kids love bagels and they love all of the hero bagels, tortillas. We've done taco night. We've done burger night with their buns. Literally everything we've ever had from them. 10 out of 10. No notes.
You'd never know it's low net carb and high fiber bread from the texture. Get the soft, fluffy experience you know and love for your next savory breakfast sandwich, late night grilled cheese, or that family taco Tuesday.
Get monthly small batch drops of indulgent favorites like their 4G net carb bagel and new surprises coming this year.
This year, hit your goals without giving up your favorite bready dishes. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code CREEPY at checkout. That's CREEPY at HERO.CO.
DeFrancesco has not claimed a supernatural source of the presence. His account was later included in discussions of the third man factor as it fit the usual pattern. People trapped in collapsed buildings, lost in wilderness, or enduring prolonged abuse have reported a similar phenomenon. In many cases, survivors describe the presence as the thing that allowed them to continue when they otherwise would have given up. The experience is often remembered with clarity long after other details have faded. Across survival accounts, the third man phenomenon almost always emerges in environments that push the human nervous system beyond ordinary limits. Survivors consistently describe the presence appearing when isolation becomes total, when there are no voices, no familiar landmarks, and no sensory variation to anchor reality. Polar explorers, stranded mountaineers, shipwreck survivors, and astronauts have all reported the phenomenon in conditions of extreme sensory monotony, where the brain receives minimal external input and must rely almost entirely on internal perception to survive.
And with the castaways at sea as well, plane crash survivors, shipwrecks, castaways at sea, a lot of them recount what they call a bioscopic fantasy, where like scenes from their life flashes before their eyes, essentially, and then the presence appears after that. So I wonder too if your brain is, you know, consciously, subconsciously, like flipping through the card deck of like, all right, who do we need to come help us? Which imaginary friend do we need to bust out to come help us? But that's they said, like, you know, I saw the day I got engaged, the day my daughter was born, the day, you know, all that stuff. So
almost your life flashing before your eyes, which a lot of people say they experience moments before death. So you experience that, and then something arrives that helps you get out of that situation. But you are on the brink of death, it appears, when it does happen.
Yeah, or like in that kind of like a dizzy, sensory deprived. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, the correlation with across cultures, the idea of kind of a vision quest or a cultural ceremony that involves, whether it's fasting or sensory deprivation, you know, alone in a remote area or whatever, that is intended to bring about a spiritual kind of thing. It's like you got yourself accidentally into a sensory deprivation situation, been set adrift.
Physical exhaustion and sleep deprivation are also central. Many experiencers report being awake for days, physically depleted and mentally disoriented when the presence appears. In these states, the boundary between imagination, perception, and self-awareness begins to blur, creating fertile ground for unusual perceptual experiences. Hunger and dehydration further weaken the brain's regulatory systems, heightening suggestibility and hallucinatory potential. Cold exposure and physical injury, broken bones, internal bleeding, hypothermia, are frequent backdrops, suggesting that intense physiological stress may trigger the experience. Finally, prolonged fear and uncertainty, especially the belief that death is imminent, seem to be one of the strongest catalysts. In these moments, when survival depends on maintaining hope and decisive actions, the, quote, third man often appears as a guiding presence that counteracts panic and paralysis. Survivors frequently describe it as arriving precisely when they are about to give up. These episodes tend to occur within what researchers call extreme unusual environments, or EUEs, like polar stations, spacecraft, open ocean, disaster zones, or survival situations, where novelty of circumstances force the human mind to operate far outside its typical context.
Well, and there's some discussion of like, why are there more instances of this? And it seems to be that there are more instances of people putting themselves in situations like this. All that to say is there's way more space travel. There's way more exploration. There's way more long-term studies where I'm going to stay in this area, or I can go climb Everest because, you know, I think whatever, I've seen so many people do it before me.
Mm-hmm. Despite cultural, religious, and personal differences, the reported characteristics of the third man are strikingly consistent. Many experiencers describe the presence as intelligent and distinct from their ordinary self, often feeling like another consciousness entirely rather than an internal thought. The presence is frequently described as calm, even when the experiencer is panicking. Survivors recall feeling steadied, reassured, or guided by an entity that seemed composed and purposeful. Most notably, the third man is often benevolent and directive. It gives clear instructions.
Keep moving. Turn left. Don't sit down. Get up.
That later prove crucial to survival. This directive quality differentiates it from chaotic hallucinations, which tend to be fragmented or disorganized.
That's a good point, I think, too.
That is a good point.
Yeah, it's more direct, and it differs from the presence that was repeatedly reported by folks, particularly in polar regions, like at Antarctic stations, where they would feel that something was like outside of their station looking in at them, or almost like watching the perimeter or watching them, but it never talked to them, and they weren't like about to die. It wasn't like, oh my God, I got trapped outside of the station and was fixing to die. It was, you know, I was going down to do my usual thing, and oh God, that one lady's name was Virginia, and the people there called it Ginny's ghost. They were like, ugh, Ginny's back there with her ghost. But it was just this ongoing presence. But in the Antarctic and polar situations, they didn't ever interact. So I'm like, is this like a mini version of a third man? It's like a two and a half man?
Or, or maybe the presence is staying outside where it's cold as a protection versus inside, because the people inside at least are sheltered.
They're like, you're safe. You don't need me right now, but I'm out here in case you get stuck.
Yeah. Like, don't worry. It's like, you know, when you're giving your kids a little more freedom at the playground, and you're like, I'm going to just stand over here and you go down the slide, but I'll be over here watching just in case anything happens.
Go over there and play. I'm watching though.
Finally, accounts emphasize that the presence is rarely chaotic or threatening. Instead, it is experienced as structured, purposeful, and sometimes even compassionate. This unusual coherence has fascinated researchers and fueled debates about whether the phenomenon is purely neurological or something more. Interpretations of the third man vary widely, shaped by belief systems, culture, and personal worldview. Many experiencers interpret the presence as divine intervention, angels, saints, or God acting directly to preserve life. Others believe it is an ancestor or deceased loved one appearing in moments of crisis to guide the living. Some describe it as a guardian spirit or protector entity, a spiritual companion assigned to safeguard them.
And there's been cases where a woman was a Buddhist and she was trapped, a roof collapsed, and she said she saw a monk come towards her and hand her an apple, and that sustained her in that moment. And then another case, one guy was a Catholic and the other was an Episcopalian, but both of them said they both saw a presence and they both recognized it as the then current Pope. So
interesting.
You know, I don't know. I don't know what form it takes or if it depends on the person, or it sounds like in a lot of cases it depends on whether you're religious or not. But they've also done studies where they've indicated if you have openness as a personality trait, like absorption of new experiences, you're maybe more likely to point it to a more supernatural reason.
I gotta say, when I felt that way in the car, it did feel like a calm, reassuring presence that was guiding me and alleviated my panic.
Yeah. And that's kind of that consistency where it's not just watching you. It's like truly the like shepherding guardian angel.
Yeah. And like a feeling of everything's going to be okay, which I never get that anymore.
So I'm telling you, I'm like, come on, third man. May we all get a third man and put their hands on our shoulders and be like, I'm going to whisper in your ear exactly what you need to do.
It is interesting. It's called third man when mostly it happens when someone is solo. So
right?
Why not second man?
I'm telling you, Shackleton's like, I said fourth man. No one listened. But truly, to differentiate it from other hallucinations, there's, of course, tons of reports of you're adrift at sea and you have hallucinations that you think that an island is close, or that you think you see a boat and like people just straight jump off of a lifeboat and try to go swim to shore. And they're just in the middle of this, and your friends on the lifeboat are like, oh, and they're dead. Like they swam out and they've exhausted themselves and they died. But those folks are like, no, it's currently happening right now and I have to go right now. Versus the third man, people are often like, what is this? Okay, I'm gonna listen to it. Like, it feels more grounded and concrete maybe versus the ones that are like in still like freak out of like, I gotta get out of here.
Like flight mode. Yeah. I can't remember which shipwreck it was. It was one that was at the time, one of the most lives lost at sea, specifically by sharks. And a lot of the men that were bobbing in the sea reported that, like, a couple people in particularly were like, no, we just got to swim down. We just got to swim down. And like, there's help down there and there's fresh water and stuff. And they're like, no, 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 don't swim down anywhere. And I mean, we can all assume that they didn't make it, which they didn't. But it is that like, that flight of, no, it's I'm panicking. This is what mm-hmm. we got to do versus a calm reassurance of like, I feel still, I feel confident, and like mm-hmm. I'm making rational, I might not be making the rational decisions, but I'm following rational yes. decisions that are being fed to me.
Like, I'm glad that my third man, there was an adult. It was an adult in the room. Yeah. It was just like, let's fucking freak out.
Mm-hmm. And with the water too, drinking salt water
yes.
causes hallucinations. So in yes. that, I don't. A little bit, I think you might be okay, but consuming yeah. large amounts can. Mm-hmm. And I think that may have been a contributing factor too, to these men feeling like they, it's a really horrible shipwreck. I wish I could remember the name of it. I could look it up and.
The Medusa, 1816, 147 people, 13 days at sea, hallucinations. People believed that land wasn't there, convinced that rescue ships were visible, jumped into the ocean, believing that salvation awaited at the bottom of the water.
That
group
that
panic.
Is it.
Only 15 survived. Cannibalism. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a rough one. That's the USS Medusa?
Not the USS, just the Medusa. The raft of the Medusa, is the painting, I think, was based on this. Yes.
Damn, dude.
Wreck of the Medusa. The Wreck of the Medusa, 1816.
We might have to cover that. That's
yeah.
such few people to survive.
Yeah, that's horrifying. Yeah.
Like everything that could go wrong went wrong. Like you're eating each other. People are hallucinating. People are jumping off the ship. Not one thing except for the handful that survived went right.
Mm-mm. Goddamn. Sinister Hood will be right back. Starting the year with a wardrobe refresh, Quince has you covered with luxe essentials that look effortless and polished. They're perfect for layering, mixing, building a wardrobe that lasts, and their versatile styles make it easy to reach for them day after day, like today when I'm wearing my Quince sweater. I love this too. I get so many compliments and I didn't even realize we'd be talking about Quince today. I just wanted to be cozy and cute.
It's very flattering. I love the cut, the color, and it's very soft. All of my Quince stuff is so soft. The Modal V-neck tees, the Mongolian cashmere sweaters, the crepe wine-colored skirt that I have to wear over tights with a little sweater and booties. All of it is so cute. And it's not going to break the bank.
Mm-mm.
We're talking Mongolian cashmere sweaters. I've got two of them. Denim that fits like it was made for you. And outerwear that looks and feels designer, but at a fraction of the price. Their wool coats, stunning. And the quality rivals brands that charge double or more.
Quince works directly with ethical top-tier factories and cuts out the middlemen. So you get those elevated, long-lasting pieces without the markup. Everything they make feels intentional and well-made, like the kind of staples you wear on repeat, like today. It's smart, stylish, and totally worth it. And I also love my alpaca wool cropped cardigan I got from Quince. And then I also got a tank from Quince that was a silk V-neck cami and deep orchid. So it's this dark purple cami with this light gray sweater over it. I feel so fashionable.
I know. Cashmere sweaters. I have one in black, one in wine. First of all, I love a V-neck sweater mm-hmm. because for me, on me personally, I find them more flattering. And it's warm enough that I could wear it right now, but layered. But it's also mm-hmm. thin enough that I could wear it in the spring if I wanted to. It's like no matter the temperature, it works somehow.
Somehow it does. This one is 100% organic cotton fisherman crew sweater. So mm-hmm. it keeps me cozy, but I can also wear it like in the fall and the spring. I don't have to like, as soon as the ice melts, I don't have to be like, I got to put my sweater up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a year rounder.
Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/creepy for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/creepy to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/creepy. Another common interpretation is the, quote, higher self or protector self, a transcendent part of one's consciousness that emerges in crisis, separate from ordinary identity. Others lean towards scientific explanations, viewing the presence as a brain-generated survival mechanism, an internal voice externalized under stress. Some experiencers combine these interpretations, believing the phenomenon may involve both spiritual and psychological components.
I think Simpson, the Touching the Void fella, believed that it was his higher self, that it was something his brain created to help him deal in the moment and to drag him out, which is one of the many common explanations.
Many survivors simply report the experience without explanation, saying,
I don't know what it was, but it felt real.
This uncertainty highlights how profoundly convincing the experience can be, even for skeptics. The scientific study of the third man began in earnest in 1955 when neurologist McDonald Critchley published The Idea of a Presence, one of the first scholarly investigations of the phenomenon. Critchley documented reports from shipwreck and aviation survivors who described sensing another being nearby during life-threatening events. Psychologists later recognized that these experiences occur across extreme, unusual environments and tend to fall into two patterns. One, the repeated appearance of a silent companion among remote explorers, one who offers no aid and merely observes. And two, the appearance of a benevolent or guiding presence in dire survival scenarios, offering guidance or aid. These findings suggest that the phenomenon is not limited to a single culture or personality type, but may represent a universal human response to extreme stress in varying degrees.
Yeah, I had never heard of the idea of the third quarter issue, which is apparently on remote exploration treks, that it doesn't matter if it's a 5-week trip, a 5-month trek, a 5-year trek, that like 3/4 of the way through, people flip out. People turn, some people become depressed, some people suffer insomnia, anxiety, a combination of a three. Some people get what they call the Antarctic stare, which is just a disassociative stare.
Thousand-yard stare.
Like, you all right, buddy? Yeah. And that oftentimes these reports of like, there's somebody out there, begin or occur. Not the ones that are guiding you in a life or death situation, but the ones that you're just like, what are you doing out there? Happen in this third quarter time that, again, it might be the brain being like, somebody's got you. Like, you only have 25% of the journey to go. Like, just stick it out. Because because it doesn't happen day one. It happens like day 75 of 100.
Day one, like, you have hope. Day 75 of 100, you're like, this hell will never end.
This is like us being stuck inside from the ice. I'm like, I was told Tuesday morning I could go back outside and run. You don't know what it does to my brain if I cannot run amongst trees. I'm going to lose it. I've been on a treadmill like a rat on a wheel.
You got to put your treadmill in front of the window where you can see a tree and trick your brain.
I told you, I was just waddling around on the ice alone.
Modern neuroscience has added experimental evidence to the discussion. A 2014 study demonstrated that a, quote, sensed presence can be artificially induced by disrupting the brain's perception of the body and self. Researchers created a mismatch between motor commands and sensory feedback, causing participants to feel another being nearby. This points to self-model disruption as a key mechanism. When the brain's representation of the self becomes unstable, it may externalize parts of consciousness, creating the illusion of another mind.
And they kind of likened it in the Third Man Factor book to some situations where you have a phantom limb after, and the type of therapy that you go through. They also describe Dr. Strangelove syndrome, which is where your hand just acts on its own after having a traumatic brain injury, and how there are something happens in, like, your brain can split to where your hand is doing something that you don't want it to do. One woman, it was trying to choke her, and she'd have to fight it and subdue it with her other hand. And there's another one that engaged in involuntary masturbation all the time, regardless of where he was at. And he was like, I'm sorry, it's not me, it's my hand. Which sucks.
They're like, okay, sir, like, sure. You said that last week, and we were all like, maybe, but again.
Like, okay, Carl. But we talked a little bit about this study and kind of the guy that preceded it, Michael Persinger, who is the Canadian professor, and he developed the God helmet, which if you all are interested, we have a mini-sode on Patreon about it, and Professor Stanley Coren, like this device that, you know, it was like electromagnetic pulses on the brain, which I thought was interesting mention of electromagnetic pulses, because in a Chilean Antarctic station where multiple people had reported a presence. It all, the area where they all saw the presence was down near the generator, the electrical generator that emitted electromagnetic pulses. So
interesting.
Does that have something to do with it? I don't know.
Clinicians have observed similar presence experiences in non-survival contexts, including grief, trauma, sleep disruption, neurological disorders, and meditation. This suggests that the phenomenon is not limited to near-death situations, but may arise whenever the brain enters altered states of consciousness.
Yeah, one of the studies was like 65% of U.S. combat veterans with PTSD reported that they heard auditory commands in like internal sounds that, you know, not we can't hear, that they felt compelled to answer. And similar adults suffering that were in quadriplegic like facilities being treated, you know, a post-accident, they said they had heard a voice as well. Like most of the time they reported it was the same gender as their voice. Sometimes they said it sounded like a family member, but it would command them and would tell them kind of what to do and how to move on a day-to-day basis in a way that they had never had that before, whatever had caused their quadriplegia.
Our brains are wild, man.
Who knows, man?
I don't know what's going on up there.
No, dude, me neither. It's a box of rocks on my side.
One emerging hypothesis regarding the phenomenon proposes that the brain simulates another mind when isolated, effectively creating a companion to preserve functioning. This, quote, hallucinated ally could serve several adaptive purposes, reducing panic and emotional overwhelm, improving decision-making by externalizing inner dialogue, and sustaining motivation and hope under extreme conditions. From an evolutionary perspective, such a mechanism could be a survival adaptation, allowing humans to maintain agency when the mind is close to collapse.
And there's a collection of third man situations where it's a specific person they see that had died in however recently. Like one woman was a diver and she had her husband was a dove with her and he had passed away a couple months before. And she was doing this dive where, you know, normally there's a line and normally he would hang on to the line. But she was so focused on collecting these samples in the Bahamas that she wasn't paying attention to the line. And by the time she turned around, she couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. And she only had so much oxygen that she really needed to quickly find it. She starts freaking out and panicking. And she said, as sure as she was like kicking up dust trying to find the line, the voice of her dead husband came in her ear and was like, all right, babe, you know where it is. Let me help you find it. And she said she found it.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the third man phenomenon is not automatically considered a psychiatric disorder. Clinicians evaluate such experiences based on three factors. One, whether the experience causes distress. Two, whether it impairs functioning. And three, the context in which it occurs. There is growing recognition in psychology that the mind can generate helper or protector experiences during crisis. Rather than being dismissed as pathology, these experiences are increasingly viewed as meaningful psychological responses. Therapeutic models such as internal family systems, or IFS, treat internal protective figures as parts of the psyche that emerge to safeguard the individual. Similarly, trauma research acknowledges self-generated compensatory protective experiences that arise under overwhelming threat.
It's almost like a imaginary friends for a kid that has gone through trauma or some, or a lonely kid, a big family change, and then they start talking about imaginary friends sometimes.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of the movie Sybil, which is based on an actual case. And that little girl created a bunch of other personalities to deal with extreme trauma and abuse that she was experiencing. It's no longer called split personality disorder, like multiple identity disorder. It is, though, a way for your brain to protect yourself from things that you don't know how to protect yourself from. But like this other, I don't want to call him a character, but part of your brain that has emerged can protect the other part.
Yeah, and that's it's interesting the shift that we've seen since that case, which that book came out in like 1970s, and I think later on they did an expose that she didn't really have those personalities, and she said she felt pressured into doing it and things like that. But there are, I mean, that's still a phenomenon in whatever way it exposes itself. But those internal family systems therapies, like new developments in therapy, like helping folks address when they feel like, no, this is a separate part of me. This is totally a different part of me. Understanding like this is a way we can help you integrate that mm-hmm. and not necessarily, you know, exploit it or encourage it.
Yeah, or shame them or make them feel like, well, let's just not talk about that. Or they get committed to an institution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm happy to see that therapists are more, and psychologists in general, the studies are like, it's not like, you know, Shackleton or any of these people had a third man. And then for the rest of their life, they had the third man and they talk about it all the time. You know, it's like a thing that you cope with and it happened when you needed it. And then it went away and you're mm-hmm. fine after. Well, I mean, fine, but, you know, afterwards.
You survived.
Yeah. Sinisterhood, we'll be right back.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step 4, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The new year means new health goals, not just for your body, but for your finances too. But did you know financial health is directly related to identity protection? You need LifeLock because your personal info is in endless places that are outside of your control. It only takes one mistake, and not even your mistake, to expose you to identity theft and lost funds. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points per second and alerts you to threats you could miss on your own. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock's U.S.-based restoration specialists will fix it, backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. In fact, restoration is guaranteed or your subscription money back. Don't face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft alone. Resolve to make identity, health, and wealth part of your New Year's goals with LifeLock. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's 40% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Culturally, openness to discussing these experiences is increasing. Support groups, books, podcasts, and documentaries now explore the third man phenomenon openly, reflecting a broader shift toward integrating spiritual, psychological, and neuroscientific perspectives. The third man phenomenon sits at the intersection of neuroscience, psychology, spirituality, and survival biology. In moments of extreme isolation and terror, the brain appears capable of externalizing a guiding consciousness, one that stabilizes emotion, directs action, and sustains hope. Whether interpreted as divine intervention, ancestral guidance, or an adaptive neural construct, the third man represents one of the most profound demonstrations of the human mind's capacity to protect itself when no one else is there. So what do we think?
When Bram Stoker's cousin Nick was like in the army, he got stuck and then he had a third man factor experience, and he later wrote to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock books. And Doyle was like really into woo-woo stuff, and he believed that he's like, someone in your party is probably mediumistic, like is a medium, and you don't know. And so when you're in that moment, like your enhanced feeling helps thin the veil, and then that's how you see these spirits or whatever. That's nice for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I feel like it's more likely what the Touching the Void fella thinks, or some of the others that have, like DeFrancesco in the 9/11 situation, where it's like your brain figures out what you need to survive. Now, how it does that, I've got no explanation, but it's like, this would help you right now. Like, I know, like, you're like, I don't know what would help me, but the better part of you is like, I got you.
To Stoker's point, Yeah. What about if you're by yourself?
Yeah.
And you're like, well, I'm not a medium that I know of. So that's what how he said. Did it happen?
But Doyle was like, or are you? He said, you might be a medium if you don't.
You might be a medium.
If you're on a hike and someone appears next to you.
You could be a medium.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of people think on some level, everybody has the capacity to tap into mm-hmm. parts of our brain that we otherwise don't use. So mm-hmm. it makes sense that in a atypical situation where you're under extreme duress, you feel like you're going to die, that something in you kicks into survival mode and a part of your brain, otherwise just kind of dormant, is like, nope, this is how we're going to get out of this. Where you got to go left, right, over that big ass mountain, but just stay calm because you're going to be fine.
No, I think you're right. Like, our brains are what set us apart from the rest of the animal kingdom insofar as we've been able to survive, do more, et cetera, and still don't understand all of it. So the fact that we know there's a mechanism that shows up in situations like this, and then it looks different to to everybody, it's going to look different. If you're religious, it's going to be Jesus. And if you're, or whatever religion you are, then I think that's more interesting to me, that I want us to do way more neuroscientific research. And it's hard because you can't be like, okay, wear this EEG helmet while you go hike Everest, you know, because if you're in the situation, you can't like test it. But if there is some way, I don't know, send people into that place that's like the quietest place in the world. I think
no one's lasted more than 55 minutes.
Yeah, I think somebody lasted, less than an hour. I'm like, I'm sure at some point it's like, don't panic, don't freak out. They're like, a third and fourth and fifth man came to be with me because I freaked out. But yeah, I think more studies on this are fascinating. You can listen to our God Helmet minisode. But that one, you know, when they tried to redo it, especially with what is the guy that was kind of a famous skeptic, and he's like, well, I didn't really feel anything. And I think that's the other part of it too, is that like, perhaps certain brains, just depending on how they're wired, our personalities, can't do it, or only will do it in a certain scenario. Like, you can't trick me with some helmet. Like, I need to really be fall through a crevasse. Yeah. But the idea that we could tap into this and conjure it when we needed it, I think is not a bad idea. If like the psychologists kind of say, like, hey, it doesn't, you know, cause you distress. It doesn't impair your functioning. It's in this context of like, you needed help. I talk to myself all the time. So I'm my own third man. I'm just like, what are we doing today? Don't shout. I hear you. Like, I'm talking to myself.
I still feel like it's misnamed. Despite T.S. Eliot's third man, I still feel like we should call it something else, since it mainly happens when you're alone. But whatever it is, I agree. If there's ways to learn how to tap into it more and use it purposefully when you need it, but maybe that's what makes it so elusive, appealing, and magical. Is that we can't. It just kind of happens when you need it most.
It's true. Or it's why I think it's why people chase like deep, deep meditation or religious experiences or whatever, because the brain waves that people get when they're meditating, what your brain looks like when it's meditating is similar to what it looked like when they put the God helmet on you, and similar to what it looks like sometimes in other situations where people have this kind of phantom doppelganger. So to figure out like how we got there, can we conjure it on demand? And from a woo, you know, kind of a woo perspective, are we, you know, does the brain have some type of second field of vision that we can't access until, you know, the rubber meets the road and we're whatever Lindbergh said, like at that last final moment before the phantoms take us. And in that case, then we don't need a God helmet. We need God goggles. We need God goggles. Coming soon.
Trademark.
Coming soon to a major retailer near you is God goals, but something like that. But I'm a start third man in myself. If I'm out in the woods and get lost, I'll be like, all right, calm down. We need to conjure an imaginary friend. I had imaginary friends as a kid. It was Ferris Bueller, Sloan, and Cameron. So
there you go.
They can come join me on my hikes if I'm by myself lost.
I, for whatever reason, and I'm not like calm in just like everyday situations, but when the rubber meets the road, like you're describing, and there's like a serious situation at hand, I've always gotten strangely calm.
Mm-hmm. You like lock in.
I do. I just lock in and I'm like, this is what we got to do. We're not going to freak out about it. This is how we're going to get out of it. And on multiple occasions, like people, it's happened at where I've worked or something. The most memorable one was when I worked at a DV shelter for women, and there was an incident. And even one of the social workers afterwards was like, "You were so calm during that." Like, that's, and a woman was like experiencing health issues and was passing out. And like, I don't know, my brain just kicks into like, you got to get shit done when stuff like that happens. So I hope that if I'm never going to climb Mount Everest, so that will never be a problem.
You're like, but if I'm in, a lot of reasons.
Oh, yeah. But if I'm in a situation where I do feel alone and need guidance, that I'm able to tap into that.
It's true. That's why I always say WWCWD.
But well, yeah, but it's like really severe situations, and in just like everyday inconveniences, not as much.
Yeah. Like if the car is spinning out on the highway, which I can attest to because I was the one driving when it spun out, and you were like, maintain the road, don't do this, da da da. And I was like, okay. It's like, and it, because it was just a like brain scramble, and for whatever reason you're like a dilated pupil, like it just goes like.
And like, I remember that.
You knew what
to say. I
think
I said, you're fine. You're fine.
Yeah,
and you're sometimes like, we're fine. It is just somebody telling somebody like, you're okay. Mm-hmm. Like, because behind the wheel is different than being in the passenger seat.
True.
So calming someone down in a really tense situation.
No, truly. And that's why I think that it's, for me, I don't really care what it is. I love that we have it. I think it saves people when they need to be saved. And for the people to whom it has happened, it was a touchstone point of their life, as I'm sure it would be if you were in an FTD, fixing to die situation. So if I ever find myself in an FTD situation, I hope, I hope it takes a whimsical form. I'll say that. But whatever. Like Danny DeVito?
He's like, hey. John Belushi, where have you been?
Fucking busting through like the Kool-Aid man. Like, I would not mind that at
Maybe
all.
Maybe it's the Kool-Aid man.
I don't reject it. I welcome it. And I accept whatever form it wants to show itself
Same.
To me.
However you need to present yourself to me, I'm willing and open to accept it.
Come as you are, is how I'm saying it. But yeah, if anybody listening has had a third man experience, or if you're a first responder on the scene and somebody's like, no, somebody was just here and someone helped me, or, you know, anything like that, we'd love to hear it, because it's interesting, much like with near-death experiences, the variety, but the similarity. Near-death experiences were, grandma's be-like stories. There's always something Venn diagram-y for us in the middle.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, definitely send those in for Freaky Friday. We'd love to hear about those. Well, if you like our free episodes, you'll love our Patreon bonus content. You can join for free to see what we're up to next, or dive into over 1,000 hours of content like Judge Christie, where I rule on petty grievances you bring before the court, True Crime Headlines, where we break down the latest news and updates in true crime, Heather Saves, where anything Heather has found late night scrolling could be discussed, and Am I the Asshole, Unpopular Opinions, and other subreddits that we feel require our input.
We also offer free trials where you join for a week at any of the tiers, check out all the perks, and cancel anytime before the trial is over without getting charged. And it's the perfect week for it because we are doing our quarterly live bonus content stream tomorrow, Thursday, January 29th at 8:30 p.m. Central. And if you join for a free trial, you can come and join that and then cancel before the week is over. You won't get charged. Or if you stick around, we got a lot of stuff. But if you haven't heard, it's a rural Facebook post from my hometown, and I found some things that I gotta share. I'm like that we couldn't hang out, but I'm also glad because I would have spoiled it all and you would have already heard them. So I'm thoroughly excited. So join us Thursday night, 8:30 Central. And if you hear this later, you can go watch the replay on demand. What else do you get if you stick around?
You get ad-free episodes, monthly live stream Q&As, quarterly live bonus content, weekly audio bonus content, minisodes, merch discounts, and a community of the best listeners on the whole internet.
Amen. And we miss you guys from Sunday Scaries. We had to cancel once due to the flu and again due to the can't travel. So
yeah,
the second we can get back together.
Hopefully this Sunday, all is well.
Please, please. Well, head over to sinisterhood.com and click shop on the top banner to check out merch like t-shirts, mugs, tote stickers, and even clothes for your kiddos.
While you're on our website, you can also review the show, submit topics for cases you'd like us to cover, your odd but true tales for Freaky Friday, and whatever bizarre or hilarious video you want us to live react to during Sunday Scaries. Our weekly live stream over on Patreon every Sunday at 8:30 p.m. Central. It's totally free. You just put in your email, you get immediate access to the chat, to the unedited videos before they go on YouTube. And just for signing up as a free member, you get a whole backlog of free content too.
Ba-bam. Follow us over on Instagram and Threads at Sinisterhood Pod. Like us on Facebook at Sinisterhood. Follow us over on TikTok and YouTube at Sinisterhood Podcast to watch clips from the episodes, live streams, and more. And if you're looking for a unique and personal gift for the Sinisterhood fan in your life, or you want to treat yourself to a beginning of the year pep talk or tarot pull, book a cameo now. We celebrate happy birthday, birth announcements, congratulations on whatever you have accomplished. We would love to create a video that can be immediately viewed and sent, a thoughtful gift that you don't have to brave the treacheries of the outdoors to purchase. Go to cameo.com/sinisterhood on a website, on the web browser, a computer for the best prices. Where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, I'm reposting anything all that kinds. Has to do with
this
with this gestures wildly around on Instagram and Threads at Christy and Wallace, and TikTok at Christy or GTFO. Heather?
I'm everywhere at Heather versus the World.
As always, the devil rules the airwaves.
Keep it creepy. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon. Here are your special Patreon shout-outs. Angel White.
Cadence Tucker.
Callie.
Haley Dixon.
Ashton Dorsett.
Emma Corbett.
Megan Neff.
Kay.
And Tristan Thompson.
Thank you all so much for supporting the show. We could not do this without you all. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. We hope we pronounce your names correctly. Stay safe, stay healthy, and keep it creepy.
Mwahaha. Sinisterhood.